How can I help? How can I be useful in ending needless suffering? Do not be afraid of work that has no end.
We have to organize a social movement.
We have an opportunity to lead by example versus just talking, hot air.
I think the more people in this fight, the more we grow. Eventually, it could change. The people are the ones that can make the change.
Can you imagine waking up every day in prison for a crime that you know that you didn't commit? Can you imagine spending a year of your life like that? How about a decade? How about multiple decades? I would love to believe, and I'm sure many people would, that in our justice system, that doesn't happen or it's impossible. But the reality is, it happens far more often than most people would be willing to admit. My guests today are Andy Wilson and Paula Mitchell. In 1986, Andy was wrongfully convicted of murder and was sentenced to life in prison without the chance of parole. However, while examining information about this case while behind bars, and by that I mean Andy was examining information about his own case behind bars, he came across evidence that indicated that law enforcement inappropriately led a key witness in a move that resulted in his conviction. Stories like Andy's, as I mentioned, are not that uncommon. As of February 2023, the National Registry of Exonerations reported that the rate of wrongful conviction in the U.S. is between 2% and 10%. With a prison population of 2.3 million people, there could be 46,000 to 230,000 innocent people incarcerated today. Today, Andy is the founding donor for the LA Innocence Project, a group that helps the wrongfully convicted and works with law enforcement to prevent these convictions from happening in the future. Andy's joined today by the group's director, formal legal director at the Loyola Project for the Innocent at Loyola Law School. Her name is Paula Mitchell. Paula helped to garner Andy's release in 2017. Today we're going to talk about the criminal justice system, why wrongful conviction happens in the first place, and how it can be prevented in the future. Andy, I can't even fathom 31 years, 32 years in prison. What is life in prison like?
It's routine. It's the time you get up in the morning. It's the time you go to bed, and you can shower when they let you shower. You got time. You got a breakfast, a lunch, and a dinner. The food I couldn't eat. Thanks to having family and stuff to look out for me. The food is not very good. I went to college on the weekends, because I had to work during the week. I worked in the laundry for about 15 years. And it's what you make out of it. I'm not a gang member, so that I don't have that problem there, My thing was, I'm looking for something legal way to get out of here, so that's where I spent my time. Thanks to Paula, it paid off.
Well, he's leaving a few things out.
He's covering the wave tops for us.
Yeah, he was in a cell, locked in a cell, a tiny cell with a cellmate, and would basically, ever cautious of his own safety, worried about somebody coming into your cell in the middle of the night, somebody opening the door so that somebody could come into the cell and do harm. And so Andy had his own self-protection device, which was to keep
a pot of hot water bottle.
But he trained himself to wake up at pure increments when the pot would boil dry so he could fill it up again.
Right.
And it wasn't just the officers you were concerned about coming in. It could be somebody coming in to hurt you or your cellmate.
Right.
And so for years after getting out.
Huh?
Aren't the doors locked?
True.
In prison?
But,
somebody can open it.
But the officer in the booth, You know, he can open up a door. It's numerous times, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, inmates running around in the day room. Not supposed to be out there.
And none of that's happening accidentally, just for clarity. I'm just trying to paint a picture for myself here.
Everybody is locked up at 9 o'clock.
Right.
Unless their door happens to open.
Everybody is locked up at 9 o'clock, and the only way that door is open is heat.
That's what I mean. The only way people are running around is if somebody's door has been
opened. The only way that door can open is him. And so, I mean, a lot of people you can't even imagine that, but that goes on. You know. I need to get in there and they hurting each other.
Yeah.
And so my point was that for years after he went home, Andy had a hard time going to bed without putting water on the stove.
Right.
How could you not?
And waking up every 2 hours.
Make sure it hasn't burnt out. And then to this day, I still get up like that. 3:30, I'm on my feet. 3:30 in the morning, every morning, I'm on my feet.
You know, the idea of freedom is an interesting one, especially if you think about it only, you look at the geography of the room we're in right now. The ability to get up and move however you want to is a beautiful thing, but if you're constrained because of your mind, because of what you had to change about who you are as a person to live through the environment that you were in, and it's still lasting years after you've been out of prison,
so
it becomes a much more interesting conversation about freedom and how free you actually are.
Some of the details of his case, there was a person who was sleeping in his pickup truck who had been robbed and stabbed. And with him at that time was his girlfriend. And this girlfriend was, she was quite young. Was it 14, 15?
15.
She had actually been a babysitter for Andy and his daughter in the year or two prior to that. And she had seen these two men come up, and they were asleep in the truck. And these two men came up, one on either side of the pickup, and they were looking for money and wallets. And in the process, the victim was stabbed. And he had this disease, von Willebrand's disease, which is sort of like hemophilia. And so he bled out rather quickly, and he passed away. And she immediately was taken to the station and asked to look at mug books. And what we know from the record is that while she was looking through the mug books, she did see a photo of Andy. And she was with her sister at the time, and her sister said, "Hey, look, there's Andy." And then they kept going, right? So for 6 weeks or maybe a little more, this witness never was able to identify anyone responsible. But this particular detective kept going around, picking her up, driving her around the neighborhood, establishing rapport, asking her to look at more lineups, until finally he showed her one more time a photo lineup that had one of Andy's photos in it. And she once again did not pick his photo. And at that point, the detective said, "What about him?" And at that point, all of these weeks later, she said, "Oh, that's him." So there were just a number of things
that can't be common practice.
No, it's absolutely not. It's unconstitutional. It's improperly suggestive. Moreover, she knew who Andy was, and she knew she had babysat for him. She knew his family. And that was it. They actually considered seeking the death penalty against Andy for this crime. And they later took the death penalty off the table. And after he was convicted, he was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. And, you know, what's troubling about these, they call it LWOP, life without the possibility of parole, is these people are basically, it's the same as a death sentence. They are going to die in prison. Unlike people who are on death row, who essentially have representation until they're executed or until their conviction is overturned, people who have LWAP don't have any further representation. Once your appeal is over, you're on your own, unless you have money to hire private counsel. So after Andy had reached out to a number of different innocence organizations, you know, none of the evidence that was collected was preserved for DNA testing. There was just, you know, good old fashioned walking around, knocking on doors, looking for witnesses, trying to re-interview people. We actually found the girl who identified Andy. And she wasn't able to recall much now, but she said, you know, she was going to stand by her testimony. And so it was only after we dug and dug and dug and were able to pull together enough evidence to persuade the judge that this was a serious case that needed to be reviewed. At that point, we were able to get more discovery from the district attorney's office. And what we learned is that the prosecutor, the trial prosecutor at the time, as they were leading up to Andy's trial, she received a phone call from the victim's best friend. And he called her and he said, you know, I think that you should look into the girlfriend, the woman who eventually identified Andy. She has attacked him in the past with a knife. She is a drug user. She has had fights with him. And in fact, there's a knife that was missing from my toolbox that I would like to see the knife that was used in this case. Maybe it's the same knife. And that trial prosecutor never disclosed any of that to defense counsel, didn't do anything to follow up and further investigate this potential lead about the possibility that this young woman who eventually became a witness for the prosecution may have actually been involved. And at that point, we had enough. And we persuaded the district attorney's office that they really needed to concede that they no longer have confidence in this conviction because there were just too many problems of constitutional magnitude. And so they agreed to overturn the conviction. What a lot of people don't know is that that's just the first step in a very, very long road to clearing a person's name to being exonerated, because the idea that they conceded that the evidence that they used to convict Andy was not sufficient, now that this new evidence had come to light, does not mean that they agree he's innocent. So a lot of times what we see in these cases is the trial prosecutor or the DA's office will say, well, there were some problems at trial, but we still think he did it. We're not going to concede that he's innocent. He didn't get a fair trial. And a lot of times they'll even go back and seek a second trial. In Andy's case, they would not concede that he was innocent. They did agree that they were not going to seek another trial after he'd spent 32 years in prison. And we had to then go back to court and fight and fight and fight for a finding of factual innocence, where we had to persuade the judge, not only did he not get a fair trial, he actually did not commit this crime. And that took another 3 years, two or 3 years. And we were successful in that. And, you know, all of this time, keep in mind, Andy has no money. He has nowhere to live. He actually went back to St. Louis to stay with his mom and his family for a while and had to continue litigating all of this after being wrongfully convicted for 32 years.
So many questions about something like this. So you are involved and you find out that this particular, it was a detective, correct? It becomes the fruit of the poisonous tree. Is it often where you can draw multiple instances back to one individual?
You would think that after we have identified this particular homicide detective who worked his entire career for the Los Angeles Police Department, and knowing what they know about how he handled Andy's case, and having him admit that he did it throughout his career, that somebody would have gone back and done an audit of every single homicide case that he ever investigated and that resulted in a conviction. To my knowledge, that has never been done. It is not a policy of the DA's office to do that, not just in LA County, but in any county. It's baffling why that would not be, you know, number one on the list of things to do when you have a situation like this. You know, times change. We get better at training police officers, at supervising police officers. You know, things in 1983 and 1984 are not the same as they are now, but there's still plenty of room for error. I think that with respect to why would a DA's office continue to push back on actual innocence? Why wouldn't they just admit a mistake and learn from it and move on is a great question. I think from an individual perspective, you know, the individuals involved It can be pretty hard to process that you might have been a part of something like that. You might have actually been responsible as a prosecutor for wrongfully convicting somebody, for wrongfully seeking the death penalty against somebody who's actually innocent. It may be just simply too much to process. I think the cognitive dissonance of, you know, how—
I mean, wouldn't you want to know, though?
You would think.
In the moments when you can't sleep and you're staring at the ceiling?
You would think. And to the credit of the trial prosecutor who worked on Andy's case, when I went and knocked on her door and asked if I could talk to her about Andy's case, she invited me in. She was willing to look through the file. And she actually was one of those prosecutors who said, I didn't disclose this to the defense because I didn't think it was exculpatory. I don't quite understand how it could possibly be perceived as anything but exculpatory, which is something the defense is entitled to. But she was honest and open about her views and willing to talk to us. That's not always the case. So I think that everyone needs to understand that there is so much room for error in the criminal justice system. We need to accept that premise, and we need to go about looking for and correcting errors and doing better going forward. It's as simple as that. It's of course, you have liability. You have, you know, counties who are ultimately responsible for wrongful conviction are going to get sued if it turns out that they were not properly training or supervising, or, you know, if this is something that somebody's entitled to be compensated for because their federal civil rights were violated, they were denied due process. That's part of the legal system as well. That's the only recourse left for somebody in Andy Wilson's position. It's not as if anyone takes any satisfaction in going after a municipality or a county in order to recover damages. That's all he has. Yeah. There's no other option. And I think a lot of counties are increasingly concerned and mindful about the numbers that go along with that. People are suing for millions of dollars, having lost decades of a lifetime. How much is a decade of your life worth? You know, one of the things that really baffles and annoys me is anytime we have a victory and we're able to get somebody's wrongful conviction overturned, almost without exception, one of the first questions asked at that interview where someone has just been released after decades of wrongful conviction is somebody will say, are you going to sue? Are you going to get a lot of money? It's like, can we just take a beat here and appreciate what just happened to this human being and his or her entire family? It's not about that. It's almost as if people think this is some kind of, you know, get rich slow scheme.
How could it be? How do you even do the math on what a decade or multiple decades of your life is worth? It's, you know, I think that question comes because that's what people place the most value in our modern society, is a number and an account.
Mm-hmm.
When did you start realizing that there was a chance that you were going to get out?
From the day you found me guilty. I wasn't going to give up.
That's an amazing headspace.
I didn't know how to give up. You know, I mean, 2 and 2 is 4, and 1 times 4 is 4. But I didn't know how to give up.
What's really incredible about Andy's story, and I see this over and over in other cases, it was entirely serendipitous that it was your cellmate, right, who had the printout that showed that the witness was paid.
Yeah.
It wasn't even his paperwork.
Somebody, my celiac went on a visit. It was Saturday. My celiac went on a visit, and I was in the cell. I like to clean up my cell, and the guy came by. He says, where's Sugar Bear? He's on a visit. He said, tell him to read this. And he gave it to me, and I put it on his bunk, you know, and I finished watching television. And when he came in, you know, I told him somebody left a book, said, read it. Well, it wasn't a book. It was
the old computer printout, like right. With dots on the side. And you
know, a dot printer?
Right.
Yes. And so he must have been messing with it for over an hour. And when he got through, he says, your name is in there. My name isn't nothing like that. My name ain't nothing like that. You know, he said, yeah, your name's in there. Well, I knew my case number, A76116. I knew my case, I knew that. And so I read it. It was the last page, about that far from the end. And now when I see my name and my case number, now I have to figure out what this really is and how to use it. And I look back and I look back and I found the officer's name, the girl's name. He gave her $1,000. You give a 15-year-old kid $1,000, you probably gave it to an all $1 bill, so she thinks she got all the money in the world. She'll do anything for that, you know? And you don't tell nobody that you're doing this. And that's the kind of stuff that goes on. And if you're not smart like this lady here legally, then it'll get by you. And you just going up the river with no help.
How do the mechanics and the execution of the release actually go? So I'm assuming at some point in time you're in front of a judge in court and they agree like this conviction is going to be overturned. How fast is it?
Great question, because it illustrates perfectly how not the system is designed for innocence. So it's different in every case. In Andy's case, this is a perfect example. He's at Lancaster. He has to appear in court, so they have to put him on a bus, bring him down to Men Central, put him in a cell at the jail, put him on a bus when it's time to go to court, go to court, have the hearing. In Andy's case, even after the judge said, Mr. Wilson, your conviction is overturned, your sentence is vacated, what do you think they did with him? They put him back on the bus. They send him back to Men's Central Jail. Yes. And then they put him in what's called high power, a special segregated area for people who are particularly dangerous. They said because they were concerned about his safety. I still don't understand that. And they kept him there for, was it two more days?
Yes.
Two more days. Sometimes it's a week. Sometimes it's 2 weeks while they do paperwork. I mean, It's outrageous. It's insult to injury. I don't even know. I have no idea why they can't do a better job than that. In Mr. Hastings' case, I mean, I guess we could take this as a sign of progress because we had front-loaded everything as much as we could. And we said, we want him to walk out of this courthouse. When you overturn the conviction, we want him out. And the district attorney's office, under George Gascon's leadership, did a lot of work with the CDCR to get all that paperwork done ahead of time so that once the court overturned his conviction, he was able to go. But he still had nowhere to live.
And that's the way it should be.
It's the way it should be. But he went to, you know, transitional housing, no money, no apartment, no lease, nowhere, you know. That's yet another example. If you're released on parole, you're given a little bit of money. You're given transportation.
Before they start sending these guys to these
transitional housing,
they would give them vouchers. They even had a voucher to stay in a hotel.
Maurice got none of that. Andy got none of that. If you're innocent, you get nothing.
I don't even know how to process that.
No, I ran into a guy over there, one of the meetings, Zoom meetings, over the OB, hooked up with a guy in, he was in Florida, and he said they locked him up when he was 16 years old in a life sentence for something he didn't do. And it, like 20-something years later, they found out he didn't do it and had to release him. So in compensation time, you know, to compensate this kid, the state said they're not going to compensate him because he had two knife beefs in prison. Well, I don't mean nothing bad about it, but they like he didn't have five or six knife beefs. He was a kid. You sent him in an adult prison. He had to look out for himself. You know, so you feel he don't deserve to be compensated for you messing over him? Take 20-some years of his life, and now because he have to protect himself, he don't deserve being compensated? That's wrong. And these are some of the challenges that these guys and women are up against when they come out of these places.
You know, people, in an attempt to defend their own reputation, or in that courtroom, it sounds like he had, that particular judge set it up to be a very controlling and powerful fiefdom where it's his way or her way or the highway. In the end, it always, I think, what it does is erodes people's faith in the actual system. In an attempt to protect an individual, it erodes faith in the overall system for everybody. It's just a net loss. How does that feel to sit in a courtroom where, from the earliest that I can remember, we're told we're going to be tried and potentially convicted or found innocent of a jury of our peers, and you're in a courtroom, you know, going in the way back time machine of 30 plus years ago. The original, Paula, was it murder? Was that the original charge?
Mm-hmm. So you're robbery, murder.
You're tried and convicted of murder, and you're sitting there in the courtroom listening to them come out with the verdict, knowing that you're innocent. I don't even know if my mind can comprehend that.
Well, you know what? I always told Paula, because people say, how do you do it? How do you just do it? I didn't have a heart to give up. My mother wouldn't let me give up. You know, LAIP, you know, we started that, you know, and Paula explained it to us and this, that, and the other. And, you know, it gives the students hands-on learning. You know what I'm saying? You know, they got forensic lab. You know, I think we're in a position to do things that a lot of people are. You know, it's science. Everything works by science now. You know. But you have to be dedicated to that kind of work, you know. I can't even imagine trying to, you know, determine something one way or the other. But, you know, we have the potential to do that now. And so I'm, you know, I really feel good about that. And my chance to help somebody.
So what Andy's describing is the Los Angeles Innocence Project. We are located at Cal State LA within the California Forensic Science Institute. And that's physically in the building where both the LA Sheriff's Department Crime Lab and the LA Police Department Crime Labs are located. So they're upstairs. It's a brand relatively new state-of-the-art facility. And then on the floor where our offices are located is the academic program. So there's a graduate program in criminalistics where a lot of the students are getting their master's degree in criminalistics. They have science backgrounds, and they're basically training to become the next generation of criminalists. So the CSI people you see on TV who go out and they collect the evidence. So those are the students that we're working with on our cases now, and they will help us look through evidence that was used 10, 20, 30, sometimes almost 40 years ago, whether it was arson or shoe impression or ballistics. And, you know, things have changed a lot in the last 30 years. And they will help us look at the types of forensic evidence that was used and say, you know, this is really not valid anymore. That's not considered reliable anymore. Things that we might want to look into in terms of the forensics. So we're the only Innocence Project in the country that's physically located in a academic forensic lab. And it's been a great partnership. We've been working with the same team, Dr. Kathy Roberts, who's the director of the California Forensic Science Institute. She has been getting a Department of Justice grant, U.S. Department of Justice grant, to look into DNA in wrongful conviction cases with me and my team of staff attorneys for the last 5 years. And the collaboration just grew, and we realized that actually able to help us more than just DNA on all the different forensic disciplines. And it's great. I mean, we're building bridges with law enforcement, and they understand, especially so great that our first case since starting the new project was Maurice Hastings, because DNA is so black and white. And, you know, there's not a gray area. We know the person who we got the CODIS hit to was convicted of committing this same crimes with this very unique MO. And so everybody was able to look at Mr. Hastings' case and say, we definitely got it wrong. And what can we learn from this? And the students, you know, for them, you know, their background is in science. They're going to go and be work in labs, probably for law enforcement. They go with us and meet our clients in prison. They've never been to prison before. They haven't sat down in a room with an attorney and a potential client or a client to hear about what happened in their case. And so this has been incredibly impactful for those students. They will tell you this is the most important experience they've had as part of their graduate education. So it's really a unique format, and it's been really rewarding for everybody involved. And it was Andy who donated $1 million to help us launch this new project. And we're really, really proud of it. And we're, of course, incredibly grateful to Andy for making it all possible.
Is the shift or the advancements in technology and science, is it helping reduce wrongful convictions moving forward?
I think it is. I think it's actually broader than that. So, you know, over the last 30 years since DNA kind of made its way into the courtroom, and now it's not just DNA, it's a lot of different forensic disciplines, but it was really only with the recognition that DNA could be used to conclusively show somebody was innocent that we've had the ability to document wrongful conviction cases. So if you look at the National Registry of Exonerations, you will see nationwide all of the different individuals who've had their convictions overturned and what the common causes of those wrongful convictions were. So it could be anything from faulty eyewitness identification to police misconduct to faulty forensics, false confessions that were coerced. And so we're now just getting to the point where we can actually study this data set. I mean, before it was just kind of, oh, this happened in Ohio, that happened in Tennessee. And there wasn't any systematic way to analyze it. And now we have that. And so what follows on that is trips to Sacramento, like Andy just did week before last, where you go and you talk to state legislators and you say, look, here's what we need to do. We need to change the statute so when people are convicted based on forensics that are no longer considered reliable, we need to be able to get back into court and talk to the judge and say, look, judge, what the jury was told 30 years ago when this person was convicted about these ballistics or this tire impression or what have you, that's not reliable. We know that was an exaggeration. That's just scientifically not reliable, and that we need to change the statute. And the states across the country are responding. They're responding to things like prosecutorial overreach. New York has a new discovery statute where if prosecution fails to turn over exculpatory evidence when they're supposed to, that statute actually has some teeth and the prosecution can be sanctioned. Things like that go a long way toward leveling the playing field. There's such a disparity of resources now in terms of what the prosecutors have at their disposal, law enforcement, investigators, lab testing, as compared to public defender offices and what those lawyers have. In turn, they have their very heavy caseloads. They have to, you know, beg and beg for the kind of expensive expert testimony they might need in a case. It's just not, it's not level at all. And so I think that as horrific as it's been to have these wrongful conviction cases come to light more and more and more all the time, it's not just going into a vacuum. I think people are paying attention and they're realizing, okay, we have to do better. We need to figure out why these are happening and how can we fix this. And so I think it's a really exciting time to be working in criminal justice reform, working on wrongful conviction cases, because it's not just, it's really important to get people out one at a time, like Andy Wilson and Maurice Hastings and people who've been wrongfully convicted, but it needs to count for much more than that. There needs to be a bigger impact. We have to go deeper and say, why did this happen? We can't let this keep happening. We have to do better.
I mean, there's obviously no way you'll ever get back the 32 years of your life that you spent in prison. And quite frankly, I don't think there's a number that could, I don't even understand the mathematical formula with that. But what do you want to do with the rest of your life?
I know one thing I will do is to continue to help, you know, try to change this, try to help, you know, we won't be able to change it. It'll never stop. but we can. I think we can make it a little better. We can, cut it down some. You don't have to be. When I first, they took me to a convention in San Diego, and I couldn't take it. I never seen that many people at one stage that had been wrongfully convicted. And now it's over 1,000 people be.
It's an annual meeting of the Innocence Network. So all the Innocence projects across the country meet once a year, and just talk about recent cases and recent developments. And they have a day that's dedicated to exonerees. So Andy, it was within a couple of weeks of his release after 32 years. 7 days, we drove him down. It happened to be in San Diego that year. And he walked into a room full of hundreds of people who had been wrongfully convicted. And it was just, it was more than he could really take.
How could it not be?
You know, it's not an accident. Exoneration is supposed to be every once in a while you can find somebody that's been wrongfully convicted. But now it's so many people. I mean, 30 and 40 years, you know, this been going on. It's been going on. It's just coming to the light good now. You know, it's nothing to see exonerate now. I talk to two or three of them every day.
Well, Paul and I, we were talking before we started rolling, and I was looking at the notes before the show, and it says somewhere a number between 2 to 10%. Of wrongful convictions. And can you explain where that number comes from and how it actually might even be inaccurate in and of itself?
So the most reliable statistic that I'm aware of is, I think it's published by Witness for Innocence, which is an organization that includes people who are sentenced to death and then later exonerated. And they've tracked very carefully across the country how many people have been convicted, sentenced to death, and then later turned out to be innocent. And that number is, figure is 5%. So, you know, my reasoning that the number is probably significantly higher than that is if you're seeking the death penalty against a defendant, there are certain procedural protections that are in place to try to make sure mistakes are not made. So if in those cases, 5% are turning out to be actually innocent, you have to imagine that the cases where there are fewer procedural protections, including cases where people may be pressured to plead guilty to something they didn't do so they can get a shorter sentence and get home to their families, or other just run-of-the-mill serious felony cases where mistakes are made, the figure is going to be higher than 5%. 5% of people who have been convicted of serious felonies and sentenced to prison are entirely innocent of the crimes that they were convicted for.
Paula, as somebody who works in this world at a very high level professionally, if you could be queen for a day, is there anything that you would start, you know, manipulating or changing about our legal system that would reduce the amount of wrongful convictions?
I think about this a lot. I think that one thing I mentioned earlier is try to address the disparity in resources that go to prosecutors and defense attorneys. But I also think that I think we need better training and supervision at all levels of law enforcement, from patrol officers, homicide detectives, to people who investigate sexual assault crimes, to everybody working in the district attorney's office. One thing that we're sort of seeing happen across the country as more DA offices get conviction integrity units, a dedicated team of prosecutors who will review cases that have colorable claims of innocence, is they start to see their work from a different perspective. Giving additional training to prosecutors about how these wrongful convictions happen and how they can be avoided, things that you might need to be extra careful about, like if all you have is eyewitness identification evidence, that might be a problem. Over 74% of all wrongful convictions involve wrongful eyewitness ID. And now we know from the experts things like, is it cross-racial? Was it a white witness and a black suspect? Was it a weapon? You have weapon focus. How much lighting was there? Was it at night? Were they running? If you have somebody pointing a gun at you, you're looking at the gun. You're not memorizing the details of someone's facial features. Things like that. All of that needs to be front and center for people whose job it is to convict people and lock them up in cages. I think that more training and more supervision and more focus on how these wrongful convictions come about would be incredibly helpful, both at the law enforcement, police officer level, and in the district attorney offices.
Yeah, that's a long road to hoe for sure. So focusing on the LA Innocent Project, I want to leave people who either watch or listen, not only with an understanding of what could potentially be construed as or an issue or a problem, however they would describe it, that's helpful, but the ability to take action if they wanted to, I think, is what's actually meaningful. And there's so many issues out there, and I don't expect everybody to attach at a deep level with everything that we talk about. But something like this where, and again, I'm speaking about myself specifically, I want the legal system to be blind, and I want that statue that's holding the scales, I want it to be balanced. And I think it's fair to say that it's not balanced for everybody. There's a diversity of balance when it comes to depending on who you are or where you are from. And there will be people who find themselves in a position like you did, Andy. If people want to get involved in helping your organization or people who have been in a position like Andy, for me, I think a lot of it, the easiest thing to say is, hey, we'll donate here. First and more importantly, I like the ability to try to point people towards educational information, because I actually find the more they know about it, the more likely they are to have a more long-term investment, whether that's monetarily or with their time. Where would you point people towards? Like specifically, how could they learn more about the LAIP, what it is that you're doing? And then if they do want to get involved from either a time perspective or monetary perspective, how can they do so?
Well, our website is innocenceLA.org. And we have information about the work we do, ways to get engaged and involved. We also really encourage people to pay very close attention to your local DA elections. We have had a measure of success, in my opinion, because George Gascon was elected district attorney of Los Angeles County. And prior to as he was running during his campaign, I spoke to him a number of times about his commitment to addressing wrongful convictions, to putting his full weight behind this conviction integrity unit, not just, consider it window dressing like a lot of prosecutors do. And he has delivered on that. He was helpful in us getting Andy's case across the finish line with respect to his actual innocence finding. So even though it might seem like the person who's elected as your district attorney in your county is not something you ever need to know about or pay attention to, it's really not true, because they set the tone for the culture in the office. They are sensitive to things like racial inequities in the system and socioeconomic inequities in the system, and how important it is that we put the few taxpayer dollars we have and resources we have to promoting peace in our communities, and not just out trying to round up people and prosecute them and make sure all of our prisons stay full. The prison guards union is one of the most powerful in the state. Just because we have built all of these prisons and have all of these cells doesn't mean they have to all be full. So I think paying attention to your local politics, paying attention to who's in charge of the highest prosecutorial agency in the county, making sure you're voting making sure the people in those positions have an agenda that is consistent with one that you think is fair and right and just is really, really important. And I think, we'd love to go around to community events. Anyone who's interested in having a conversation with Andy or Maurice or Jane Dortic or Frankie Carrillo or any of the exonerees we work with, just to learn more about it. We go to high schools, we go to colleges, and we just want to make sure everyone understands what the system actually does and is capable of doing, both things that are working and things that definitely are not working.
After spending time in there and you see that, you're lucky, you made it out of here, I can't turn my back on people like that, we can't free everybody, but what we can, we do what we can, and I'm grateful for that.
Hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you want to learn more about Andy, as well as Paula and her team's work, be sure to check out the Los Angeles Innocent Project at innocenceLA.org. That's innocenceLA.org. See you all next week.